marvelous chapter it is, and a notable chapter. All of us have memorized portions of this great chapter. But James introduces this great chapter to us by presenting a problem. And here is the problem that he presents in verses 1 to 4. He said, "My brethren, do not hold the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with partiality. For if there should come into your assembly a man with gold rings and fine apparel, and there should also come in a poor man in filthy clothes, and you pay attention to the one wearing the fine clothes and say to him, 'You sit here in the good place,' and you say to the poor man, 'You stand there or sit at my footstool.' Have you not shown partiality among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts?" We'll come back in a few moments and analyze those verses and exactly what is he talking about in verse 1, the faith, and what is he talking about partiality, and what is he saying concerning your judges of evil thoughts. Suffice it here to say that he is presenting a problem, that here is a problem of showing partiality. And in that context of showing partiality, he illustrates it with this example of a rich man coming into your assembly. At the same time, a poor man comes in and you show favoritism to the rich man. He says you're showing partiality. And having presented that problem, then James implores his readers to listen. Notice in the very next verse, "Listen, my beloved brethren." Listen, my beloved brethren. "Has God not chosen the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which is promised to those who love him?" I want you to pay close attention to this idea of "listen, my beloved brethren." It is translated by the contemporary English version to "pay attention." Pay attention to this, brethren. Phillips translated, "Notice, my beloved brethren." It's tantamount to saying, pay very close attention. We as preachers, our teachers of Bible classes, quite often do that. You say a lot of things, all of which you think to be important, but then you say at one point, "I want you to listen very carefully to this. I want you to pay very close attention to this one point. Or if you don't get anything else, get this point." And so he implores his hearers to listen. And what he is doing is calling for a different mindset. He is saying in this context, there is the presentation of this problem, verses 1 to 4. And by saying, "Listen, my beloved brethren," he is calling upon them to shift and make a different mindset, to develop an entire different mindset than was described in verses 1 to 4. And that's what we're going to pay attention to here in our study. So let's talk tonight about "listen, my beloved brethren." Here is a call for a different mindset. Perhaps there's a time when we need to be called to a different mindset, where there may be something going on in our life, here is some practice in our life, or a lack of practice, where we need to be called to a different mindset. "Listen, my beloved brethren." Now there are several things we want to draw attention to in this context, and we're going to take all of our points from this context. And let's start with this. We need to be called from partiality to equal treatment. That's a change of mindset. If our mindset is directed toward partiality, then we need to be called to a different mindset of equal treatment. And that's what he describes here in verses 1 to 9. And so let's talk about partiality as described in these first 9 verses. Let's talk about the partiality particularly mentioned here in verses 2 to 4. We're talking about, we've already read verses 1 to 4, favoritism that is based upon external and worldly grounds. That's what is under consideration in this context. Favoritism that is based upon external and worldly grounds. This is not favoritism that is based upon someone's superior spirituality, but upon worldly and external grounds. Here are some translations of that. The English Standard and the American Standard both said you make distinctions. Let's go back now to verse 1, he talks about with partiality, and in verse 4, where you show partiality, those translations will say you make distinctions. In other words, you make distinctions in people. That is, you treat one way and you treat another person the other way. The New Century, the NCV says that you are making some people more important than others. Now, that's kind of a free and eclectic translation, but nonetheless, it gets the point. That you treat some people more important than others. That's favoritism. That is partiality. Well, he, in this context, gives a hypothetical instance to illustrate. And what is his hypothetical instance? I do not think he's saying this has actually happened to those who he wrote. It may have. But he's describing a hypothetical instance that there is the tendency to show partiality. And for example, in this hypothetical instance, there is one who comes in who is rich and who has, notice it, verse 2, they have gold rings and fine apparel. Some scholars suggest that that may suggest something of political rank. It may suggest one who is of a ruling class of people that would be revered among men. Whether that be the case or not, nonetheless, it suggests something of their richness. But the rich are received and the rich are welcome, and that's good. And that's not what is condemned. Let's go back now to verse 2. Should one come into your assembly with gold rings and fine apparel, and also a poor man come in, and you pay attention to the man wearing the fine clothes, and you say, set here in the good place. That's not what's condemned in the text. He's not saying you did wrong when you showed attention to the rich. The problem was that what is condemned is the poor did not receive the same kind of treatment. So here comes one in filthy clothes or cheap rags. We'll say more about that a little bit later, but maybe perhaps that's a beggar. In contrast to the rich man who has the gold rings and the fine apparel, here is a man who has cheap rags because he's a beggar. And what do you say to the poor man? You say, sit here at my footstool, or you stand over there, but you don't give him the chief seat near the front of the synagogue. You don't give him the chief spot. And it is that kind of distinction where you're making some people more important than others, as per one translation, that is wrong. So distinctions are made. That's the idea of partiality. There's distinction in classes of people. Now let's raise the question, what is the problem with partiality here in the context of verses 1 to 9? What's the problem with that? And as we do that, we might be thinking, what would we do in that circumstance? And we'll make application of that in just a moment. Let's look at some things now in the context. What's the problem with partiality? First of all, it is contrary to the faith. In verse 1, when he talks about faith, I do not think he's talking about faith in the subjective sense, but faith in the objective sense, that it is the objective faith, the faith, in other words. Same kind of concept in Galatians 2 and in verse 6 or 16. The faith, or the complete canon, or the completion of the word. So he said, my brethren, do not hold the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with partiality. In other words, it is contrary to the faith. God has not ever, nor does he ever show favoritism. God is no respecter of persons. Romans 2:11, Acts 10, and in verse 34. Both of those passages say God does not show partiality, or God is no respecter of persons. So the first thing wrong with it is contrary to the revealed scriptures or the faith. So you, in other words, you can't hold to the faith and say I'm following the faith and show partiality at the same time. Here's the second thing. Notice in verse 4. Verse 4 says, have you not shown partiality among yourselves and become judges of evil thoughts? What you're doing in partiality is making distinctions from wrong motives. One translation says you make judgments based upon wrong motives. In other words, selfish motives. You see the rich man and you think, I can benefit from the rich man. He may do something for me. He may do something for the congregation. He may contribute to our cause. And out of selfish or wrong motives, you show favoritism toward him. The beggar doesn't look like he can do anything for us. In fact, I may have to do something for him. And so consequently, we don't show any favoritism toward him. Another translation says, you become judges with evil motives. Well, that is an evil motive. When you look at the rich man and what can he do for me? How can he benefit me somehow? What am I going to get out of this? You're judges from evil motives. It's judgment that is not fair, nor is it impartial somehow. And that's what's wrong with partiality. Here's a third thing that's wrong with partiality. What's wrong with the partiality? It disregards the poor. Verses 5 to 7. Now, we haven't read 5 to 7 yet, so let's begin at verse 5. Listen, my beloved brethren, has God not chosen the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he promised to those who love him. But you have dishonored the poor man. That's an expression we want to pay attention to. You have dishonored the poor man. Do not the rich oppress you and drag you into court? Do not they blaspheme that noble name by which you are called? Now, what did we just see? Well, here's another translation of verse 6. But you show no respect to the poor. You disregard the poor. In the scenario, the for instance illustration that he gave, you show regard for the rich, but you have no regard for the poor. You disregard the poor. In other words, you insult the poor. That's an insult to them. Were you rushing over to the rich man and say, here, have the chief seat. But to the poor man, well, you can say to whoever you want to, just find your seat, just it doesn't matter because we really don't care about you. You've insulted. The poor is the idea. Now notice at verse 5, there are four things that God has chosen. It is ignoring the faith and making distinctions with the wrong motives, but it disregards not only the poor and insults them, but it's also disregarding the choice of God. What has God chosen? Look at verse 5. God has chosen the poor of this world. In other words, God doesn't make distinctions, and so God is not one that looks at the rich and he looks at the poor and says, I like the rich better than I like the poor. But God has chosen the poor. In what sense has God chosen the poor? It is the poor that are most likely to accept the gospel because the rich are self-sufficient, they think. Remember in Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 12, when the children of Israel got into the land of Canaan and they have it better than they've ever had it before, they would forget about God. So in that sense, God has chosen the poor. God has chosen the poor to be rich in faith. What God looks at is not the richness of the material things, but God looks at the richness of their faith. Here's something else God has chosen. Look at verse 5. Those who are heirs of the kingdom. God's concerned about where the one is an heir of the kingdom. The poor are those who become the heir of the kingdom, generally speaking, because of their richness in faith. But God is more impressed with being heirs of the kingdom than he is material things. More about that in a moment. And furthermore, verse 5, God has chosen those who love God. In other words, when God looks at a person, God chooses the poor. Now, why does God usually choose the poor? God's looking for those who are rich in faith, heirs of the kingdom, and those who love God. He's not looking at their material gains. He's not looking at their fine clothes. God is not looking at those things that are described in verses 1 to 4. Here's a fourth thing that's wrong with partiality. And that is, it is contrary to love. Look at verse 8. Now we're going to come back to verses 6 and 7. We haven't forgot those. Let's get ahead though to verse 8. If you fulfill the royal law, it's called the royal law perhaps for two reasons. It's royal because it came from the king himself, and thus it's a royal law. It's a supreme law because all others hang under this law. So perhaps for two reasons it's called the royal law, but nonetheless, if you fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you do well. What he's saying is that this concept of showing partiality in contrast to equal treatment, the problem with partiality is contrary to love. You're not showing love toward that poor man in that disregarding him and insulting him. Furthermore, verse 9. Because of verse 8, calling that the royal law, he says that if you show partiality, you commit sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. He decided the law, verse 8. If you violate that law, it's a sin. So what's wrong with partiality? It's sin. It's contrary to the law. It disregards the poor. It makes distinctions with reference to wrong motives. And it's contrary to the faith. But one more thing that he lists here of six reasons or problems in the context that's wrong with it. Let's go back to verse 6 and 7. I said we'd come back to that. It honors the very ones that oppose the righteous. Now he's talking in general terms. He's not saying that all rich people oppose those who are righteous, because there are righteous people who are rich sometimes. And there are poor people who are wicked and have no use for righteousness. So he's talking in general terms. This is in the context of persecution. It starts in chapter 1 of the book of James. And in this context, it's generally those who were rich who were oppressing the poor. It's generally those that were rich that were oppressing those who were Christians. So let's go back now to verse 6. And he said, did not the rich oppress you and drag you into the courts? It's those who the oppressive rulers were those who were rich. And that's why some suggest maybe the gold rings and the fine apparel suggest this was a ruler that comes in, maybe of a senatorial kind of candidate. And he comes in and you begin to bow down before him as if he's some great being and, oh, here, have my seat over here in the synagogue, or here, my seat in the assembly. You are somebody important. Do you not realize that's the kind of class of person that has oppressed you? Look at verse 7. Are not they the ones, and I'm paraphrasing verse 7, are they not the ones that blaspheme the name by which you're called? Aren't they the very ones that are blaspheming and ridiculing Christianity? Someone maybe a good illustration of that. Suppose somebody of notoriety of the media, television media, were to come into our assembly, and we recognize them and we just rush to them. Oh, here, have a seat next to me because you're somebody important. And do you not realize these are the very people that ridicule Christianity? They make fun of us all the time and they belittle Christianity all the time. And we're going to show favoritism to them and the poor man that may have obeyed the gospel, we push him aside. Those six reasons are the problems with that. Now, before we leave that point, may I suggest that possibly we might need a different mindset with reference to that. How so? We could be showing favoritism to the rich over the lowly. You say, well, I don't do that. Well, I like to think I don't do that either. But in reality, if you were standing at the door and you saw somebody drive up in a real nice car, and I'm talking about maybe it's a Mercedes or something richer than that, and they get out, and it's obviously they're decked out in some of the finest clothes, and you can tell the rings they have on the jewelry. It's all real. This isn't made up stuff. This isn't the fake. This is real stuff. And you can see by the dress and the purse she's carrying, that's the stuff that you buy in New York. That's real stuff. That you might be tempted to usher them in and say, here, you can have my seat. You can sit where I sit, and I'll sit somewhere else. And then here comes a beggar coming in a car that's backfiring as it comes into the parking lot, and he pulls off into the grass because the oil's leaking out of that, and it looks like a rust bucket, and he gets out, and his clothes look like he slept last night in it, and he comes in, and he obviously smells, and you know he's begging, and you say to him, well, just sit back there in the vestibule, and we'll deal with you later. We could be guilty of the same thing. We could be showing favoritism to the educated over the unlearned. We could be showing favoritism to one race over another, or maybe favoritism against one race. We could be showing favoritism to family and friends. More about that perhaps a little bit later. Here's a second thing in the context. Same verses, verses 1 to 9. Call to a different mindset. From a double standard, or from double standards, I might say, to having the same standard. There needs to be a shift in the mindset. Now, let's talk about the double standard. What are we talking about when we talk about a double standard? A double standard is where we use one standard to judge one, and then we use a different standard for all others, or for someone else. Double standards are unfair. Double standards are unfair, aren't they? If you walk into the store and you ask, how much is this product here? And the person in front of you, they price it at $100. And then when you say, I didn't catch, what was that price now? And they say for you, it's $200. That's not fair. It's a double standard, isn't it? You see, favoritism is a double standard. That's what we just talked about in verses 1 to 9. The treatment of the rich being different from the poor is a double standard. Now let's talk about the problem with double standards and let's follow some things in the context. We're going to look at some of the same things. But let's go back to verse 1. The double standard doesn't follow the one standard, which is the faith of verse 1. It doesn't follow the one standard. You remember verse 1 talked about the faith? The objective faith, the complete canon. That is, the revealed will of God. It doesn't follow the one standard by which you judge all men. If so, there wouldn't be partiality, would there? Secondly, it's selfish. We've already noticed the selfishness in verse 4. Double standards where I use one standard to treat these people, but then I use a different standard for someone else or a group of other people. I'm driven by selfish motives. If it's unloving, verse 8, contrary to the royal law, which you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But let's go now to verse 8, and I want you to notice something else. And that is, it fails to do this. It fails to treat the neighbor as you expect for yourself. Notice what he says the royal law is. You shall love your neighbor. It's not all it says. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. You should have the same kind of love for them that you do for yourself. What do you expect to be done for you? What kind of treatment do you expect of yourself? How do you expect others to treat you? That's how you should treat them. A double standard fails to treat your neighbor as you expect for yourself to be treated. Now, before we leave that point, may I suggest it's very possible that we need a different mindset with double standards. How so? Could it be that we treat others one way, but expect something different for ourselves? Do you ever do that? Remember Matthew 7, verse 12, as you with men do, you do even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets. The golden rule, by the way. But do you ever treat someone one way, and then you expect the other people to treat you different than that? That's a double standard. In other words, I got a rule for myself, and then I've got rules for you. That's a double standard. Maybe we need a different mindset. Do you have one rule for your family, but then another rule for others? In other words, you hold others to this standard, but your family's held to a different standard. You lower the standard for your family. Do we do that? So that my family's okay, but I hold your family to a higher standard. That's a double standard. Perhaps we need a different mindset. When we criticize in one what we'd accept in someone else, that's a double standard. In other words, we're criticizing in someone that we have conflicts with and think somebody we really don't like that. Well, we're criticizing, but the same thing is going over here with my best friend, and I don't criticize that. In fact, I tolerate it. And I don't seem to mind it over here, but I don't like it over here. That's a double standard. When I'm pointing my finger at this person doing something when this one's doing the same thing, but I don't complain, that's a double standard. Perhaps we need a different mindset. Hypocrisy is when we hold others to a higher standard than we do ourselves. I expect you to follow the law, but I don't expect it for myself. Here's a third thing. Call for a different mindset. And we need to be called from a material priority to a spiritual priority. Same verses, verses 1 to 9. Material priority to a spiritual priority. Now, the partiality we've been talking about is based upon material priority. How so? The emphasis is on the external, not on the spiritual. Let's go back to verses 1 to 4. In the for instance that he gave, beginning at verse 2. They come into your assembly. A rich man has gold rings and fine apparel. And there also come in this beggar in cheap rags or filthy clothes. Where is the emphasis? The emphasis is on the external. You're not looking at either one of them and saying, you know what? I'm not seeing a rich and poor man. I want to see something about their faith and do they love God and are they interested in spiritual things. It doesn't matter if they're rich or poor. I want to know if they're interested in spiritual things or not, but as I welcome them in. That's not the focal point. The fact that he runs over to the rich man means he's focusing on the external and not the spiritual. The emphasis is on the material. He's impressed with the gold ring, impressed with the fine apparel, and he's impressed with the riches that he has. Nothing impressive at all about the poor man. Now, verse 5 tells me that in this scenario, seemingly the poor man may be rich in faith. He may be an heir of the kingdom. He may be a godly Christian, maybe. But we don't seem to be impressed. Not in this scenario. We're impressed with the fact of the gold ring and the fine apparel. Now, the priority is all backwards is the point. And we need to be called to a different mindset. Let's go back to some things we've already noticed before we go to the next point. What is it? Well, notice he talks about where the emphasis needs to be. Let's go back to verse 5. Let me paraphrase verse 5. Listen, my beloved brethren, have you forgotten? I'm paraphrasing. I'm not reading. Listen to this, brethren. Have you forgotten where God makes his choices? Have you forgotten what is important to God? What's important to God? Well, verse 5, being rich in faith. Not rich in material things. What's important to God is that your faith is full and your faith is rich. You see, that rich man may be poor in faith. The poor man may be rich in faith. Have you forgotten what's important to God? Of being an heir of the kingdom. This man may be an heir to some royalty, and that's why he's got so much money. And this poor man may be the heir of the kingdom that really matters. What God focuses on in verse 5, is those that love God, verse 8 as well. That's what's important. And notice in verses 6 and 7, here's what the rich people sometimes do. They do everything they can to offset spirituality. They do everything they can to offset righteousness. They do everything to kill your influence of righteousness. Don't be thinking about the importance of material things. Now, let's turn to another passage, and that is, we looked at this in the Bible class this morning, the value of the spiritual ought to have top billing when Jesus said, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. It ought to have top billing. And so I ask, could it be that we may need a different mindset when it comes to the material priority versus the spiritual? How could that be? How do we judge success? How do we judge success? How do you judge success? When you talk about somebody being a successful person, do you judge it on material basis or on spiritual things? And when you're looking for someone for your children to marry, are you hoping that they find somebody that's a material success, or are you hoping somebody will have a spiritual success? Had you rather your child marry someone who is rich but is not an heir of the kingdom and is not rich in faith, or had you rather them marry somebody that might be that poor beggar, but they're rich in faith and an heir of the kingdom? Which had you rather? How do you measure success? How do you measure a person's worth? We often talk about what someone is worth. You can do a Google search and ask, what is Bill Gates worth? What is Donald Trump worth? What it means is, how much money do they have? How do you measure someone's worth? Would you look at the rich man and say, he's worth a lot? Or do you look at the beggar and say, you know what, he's worth a lot because he's got a soul just like that rich man? How do you measure worth? Where do you spend most of your time? Do we spend most of our time focusing on the material, making money, and then very little attention to our souls? When you think about the work of the church, do you think about what's going on in the material building, or do you think about the spread of the gospel? I've known of places that talk about, and churches have talked about, we need to be active in the kingdom. What they mean is, we need to be spending on the building. We need to be doing painting. We need to do things to take care of the material grounds. Our focal point is on the material priority and not on the spiritual. Here's something else. Let's go now to verses 10 to 11. We've been spending our time in the first three points on verses 1 to 9. Let's go to verses 10, 11, 12, and 13 now. 10 to 13. We need a different mindset. There is a call to a different mindset from piecemealing to the whole law. What is piecemealing? That may be a new term for some. To piecemeal simply means you take one part of the law that is as being important and binding, yet disregard another as minor and insignificant. I want to emphasize that again. Piecemealing is where you take one part of the law and view it as important and as binding, and yet you disregard other parts of the law as minor and insignificant. That's called piecemealing. Where, in other words, you go through and you say, I like this, and I like this, and this is important, and this is important, and that's really what the law that I'm going to live by, and disregard all the rest. Now, the context here talks about partiality, but it also talks about some other things in verses 10, 11, and 12, and 13. We'll come to those verses in a moment. Let's get ahead of ourselves to look at verse 11. For he who said, do not commit adultery and do not murder, yet if you do not commit adultery and you murder, etc., you're a transgressor of the law. Well, here perhaps is the context. Here is someone who shows partiality, but they may be strict on other things of the law, like no adultery or no stealing. Can you imagine standing back in the vestibule of the situation that he's talking about and some brother going up, I tell you what, we take a strong stand in this church against adultery. Boy, we take a strong stand against stealing. We won't tolerate stealing at all. And you see a rich man come in, oh, you sit right here in my chief seat. And you say to the poor man, you get on out of here and sit on the back row or something. You don't care a thing about him. And here is giving emphasis to one part of the law while neglecting another part of the law is the idea. Now, the text says you need to take the whole law. Now, let's get verses 10, 11, 12, and 13. Let's read those verses together, at least particularly verse 10. For whoever shall keep the whole law and yet stumble in one point is guilty of all. For he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not murder. Now, if you do not commit adultery, but you commit murder, you have become a transgressor of the law. Now, we'll stop there and we'll get to 12 and 13 in just a second. What I'm learning from verse 12 or verse 10 is the law is a package deal. Look at verse 10 again. Whether you're talking about Old Testament law or you're talking about New Testament law, law is a package deal. It comes as a package deal. In other words, you can't piecemeal. That's what his point is. Whoever shall keep the whole law and yet offend in one point, he's guilty of all. But the king in his commentary on James said it well. He said, it is not as if he has broken a law. Rather, he has broken the law. And since he has chosen to breach it in this one particular, he has broken the whole of it. That's the point. That's the concept. That's the idea. Doesn't mean he's broken every single law. That's not what his point is. But the law came as a package deal. And so you've broken the package deal, or you have accepted the package deal, is the idea of verse 10. We must take the whole law. Now, verse 11 we have already read. The point is that the author of one part is the same author of another part. It's not that the law was written by different authors. It's not talking about the authors like Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, etc. But the inspired author. God wrote all parts of the law. And it's not like one God wrote one part and another God wrote another part, and you say, well, this is my God, and that's what I go by, and that's not my God over there. But the same God that said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not murder. It's the same law. And we can't piecemeal. Let's go further. Verses 12 and 13. We will be judged by the whole law. That's the point of 12 and 13. So speak you and so do as those who will be judged by the law of liberty. In other words, so act and so behave yourself as if you're going to be judged by the law of liberty. Now, verse 13. For judgment is without mercy on the one who shows no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. That is, by the way, in the context, those who are showing partiality not showing any mercy. But now here's the point. We're going to be judged by the whole law, not just the part we like to emphasize. I want you to think about that for a moment. Think about that. Probably every one of us would be guilty of this in some fashion, that you search through the law, and here's a portion you really like to emphasize because you can practice it well and you think others don't. So you like to emphasize that. And here's a section I like to emphasize because I do well on that, and I like to emphasize that to others. And somebody else has another favorite section they like to emphasize. But the text is saying we're going to be judged by the whole law, not just the part I like to emphasize, not just the part I might be good at. We're going to be judged by the whole law. So the point is, notice at verse 12, so speak and so do as those who have been judged by the law of liberty. What's his point? You live in view of how you're going to be judged. I'm going to be judged by the whole law. Yes, I like doing this part of the law, and this is the hard part, but I need to be doing that too because I'm going to be judged by that as well. I can't piecemeal, in other words. Here's a principle I'm learning from verses 10 through 13, and that is if we become lax in one part, we're likely to become lax even in another. And so you take the whole law, but here's one part I've become lax in, and I kind of think, you know what, that's unimportant. It won't be long till here's another section that I think is not unimportant. Here's another section that's not important, and here's another section that's not important. May I suggest that maybe we need a different mindset with reference to that? How so? You ever hear someone say this? When questioned about their sin or something they're doing, well, if that's all I ever do that's wrong, I don't think I'm too bad. If I just offend in one point. In other words, that saying, basically, it's the idea, I've kept most of the word, I've kept most of what God said, I do most everything. Generally speaking, I am submissive. We need a different mindset that we have the whole law and not piecemealing. When we redefine the law, so is what I'm doing is not sin. That's piecemealing. Now, the law still defines what you're doing is sin. Don't forget that. But what I'm doing, I don't think is sin anymore because I kind of shifted the definition on that for myself. When we begin to make distinctions in laws, we may not formulate it, but laws that are important and laws that are unimportant. You see, what you're violating is very important. What I'm violating is not important. That's the distinction I make. Then we need to be called to a different mindset. When the emphasis is on the part wherein I do well and I ignore the rest, Maybe attendance is easy for you. So you give emphasis to attendance, and people who violate that, you call their attention to the fact you're not doing what you should, and yet at the same time, I might ignore the passages that deal with discipline of children. I may not be disciplining my children at all. But I'm a stickler on attendance, though. And anybody who violates that is going to get my wrath because I'm going to tell them they're doing wrong when I may be ignoring another part of the law. Here's another example. Maybe I'm a keeper at home, and yet I ignore modesty. Maybe do quite well in keeping the house, but modesty is the thing that goes out the window, maybe vice versa. Or maybe marriage is for life. I've got that. We wouldn't think of divorce. Divorce is out for us, and yet we ignore leadership and submission. Here's one part of the law that's important, but here's another part that is not. Now, here's the last thing. Begin at verse 14 to the end of the chapter. That's a larger section. But it's not going to take that long to look at that. Let's look at 14 to 26. Here's what he says. Here's a call to a different mindset from an inactive faith to a working faith. Here's a shift, just like all the other shifts we've seen. Starting at verse 14, he talks about two things. He talks about an inactive faith. He talks about a working faith. Let's talk about each of those. Let's talk about the inactive faith. Here is one that has faith, but didn't have their works with it. He says, I have faith, I believe, I acknowledge God, I believe God, but where are your works that show you're doing what God? Well, there's not any there. Let's see what he says about that. Beginning at verse 14, he says, what does it profit a man if he says he has faith but he doesn't have works? Can that faith save? Or can faith save him? In other words, can that kind of faith, not asking can faith save him, but can that kind of faith save him? Is what he's asking, and the answer is no. That's an inactive faith. It can't save. Faith has to be obedient. You remember Matthew 7 and verse 12. Secondly, it is dead. It's inactive. It's empty. It's useless. It's worthless. So his point here is it's dead. Look at verse 17. Thus also faith by itself, if it doesn't have works, is dead. It's a dead faith. Can't do anything. Look at verse 20. Verse 20. But do you know, O man, O foolish, but do you I'll get it right in a moment. But do you want to know, that's it, O foolish man, that faith without works is dead? What's his point? Faith is dead. It's inactive. It's useless. 14 to 16 now. He's saying it doesn't profit anything. What about an inactive faith? Well, it can't save and it's dead. It's empty. It's useless. It doesn't profit anything. What do you mean it doesn't profit? Let's get verse 14 now. Verse 14, can that faith save him? Now what he does is he states the fact that it doesn't profit anything, and then he illustrates how that works. What's his illustration? Well, let's look at verse 15. If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, that is in their need of daily needs, that's the point. And one of you says to him, depart in peace, be you warmed and filled, but you do not give him the things of which needed for his body, what does it profit? In other words, he's showing something that was useless, and that illustrates the useless faith. What's his illustration? Well, if some brother or sister has physical need, and they come to you and they say, well, I have need of food, clothing, and shelter. I don't have any of that. And you say to them, depart in peace, be you warmed and filled. In other words, you put all the responsibility on them, and you take none for yourself. What you need to do is take care of yourself. You just go, get out of here. You go take care of yourself. You're saying that didn't profit them at all. So likewise, faith without works is of no profit. That is of no more value than you saying to someone, be warmed and filled. How did that get them any help? It doesn't give them any help at all. So he states it and then he illustrates it. Now, his point is that true faith is more than acknowledgement and verbalization. Faith is not something I just say to people. You know what? I have faith. I have strong faith. I really believe this. I believe every word in this text. True faith is more than that. Look at verse 19. What about this inactive faith? It's no better than the devil's. You see, when you say, you know, I have faith, well, what are you doing with that faith? Well, I'm not doing a lot with my faith, but I really have faith now. I really have strong faith at that. You're no better than the devil's because they can claim that. Look at verse 19. He said, you believe that there is one God, you do well. Even the demons believe and tremble. Even Satan believes in God. Even the demons believe in God. And so you're no better than that. That's an inactive faith. Now let's talk about a working faith now. That's what he talks about in this context as well. What does he say about a working faith? Works show our faith. Let's look at verse 18. But someone will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without your works and I'll show you my faith by my works. Now there's a lot of discussion among commentators about verse 18. What is the discussion? Is this an adversary of James that is much like Paul does sometimes? He raises the argument. Someone has said or someone has argued and he answers the argument. And so, so is that what he's talking about? Is it some kind of adversarial comment that he's responding to? Well, some think so. Others, and I think it's more likely, that he's talking about two mindsets or two concepts as if they are to be separated. So let's go back to verse 18 with that in mind. But someone say, you have faith and I have works. In other words, someone says, I have faith, but I don't have works, but you have works and you don't have faith. As if they could be separated. And so I have faith and you have works. And he said, that's not the way it works. That's not the way this all works together. Faith and works work together. It's not that one has faith and he really doesn't have works, and then one has works and he doesn't have faith. But true faith and true works go together. And so there is no such thing as saying, I have faith and you have works, and I'll show you my faith, show me your faith without works, and I'll show you my faith by my works. His point is that works show and demonstrate our faith. They work together. If you really have faith, your faith is demonstrated in your action. Now, he gives two examples of a working faith. Let's see what they are. Starting at verse 21, he's taking Abraham as an example. Was not Abraham, our father, justified by works when he offered up Isaac, his son, on the altar? The scripture said he believed God and was counted unto him for righteousness. He was called a friend of God. He was a man of faith, verse 23, but he had works that went with that. So here was a man of faith, and yet he acted upon that faith. He did something with that faith. That faith led him to do something. Second example. It was Rahab. Look at verse 25. Likewise, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? She had faith, but she didn't just sit back and do nothing. She acted upon that. So here are two examples of how faith works. Now, may I close by suggesting to you that we may need a different mindset with reference to an inactive faith and a working faith. When we cease working and acting upon faith, then we are indeed dead. When we begin to reach the point that we no longer read our Bibles, you say, I have faith. I still go to church and I have faith. I believe in God. When we reach the point that we're no longer reading our Bibles, and when we're no longer praying every day, and we're no longer worshiping and praising God, even though we even may be in the assembly, and when our charitable deeds toward others have ceased, and we're no longer active in serving, and when we have no evidence or very little of spiritual life within us, we indeed are dead. And thus we have a call for a different mindset. What have we seen? Listen, my beloved brethren, listen very carefully. Listen very carefully is what he's saying. Why? Because we need a different mindset. We need to shift from one to the other. Like what? We need to shift from partiality to equal treatment, from double standards to the same standards, from material priority to spiritual priority, from piecemealing to the whole law, and from an inactive faith to a working faith, to a different mindset. That's what James is talking about in chapter 2. There may be one or more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and sing?
What can wash away my sins?